Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't obey.
So, welcome to Hidden Stories of Faith in Appalachia. My name is Rob Music. I'm the campus chaplain at the University of Pikeville, and we're exploring faith in the mountains of eastern Kentucky or central Appalachia. We're looking at stories of people who maybe you don't typically think about when you think about all the stereotypes that are raised from our region. And in this podcast, we're incredibly thankful for Kentucky for the Humanities and the Endowment for the Arts and their sponsorship. But today I'm excited about our guest because he's currently a chaplain, but doing some really hard stuff. Our guest today is a person I really admire. And when we think about chaplaincy, we think about a medical chaplain or maybe a military chaplain, but there's so many other chaplains that we oftentimes aren't thinking about. So I'm going to have our guest introduce himself and then we'll get started.
I'm Gray Smith, and I'm the chaplain at Southeast State Correctional Complex in Wheelwright, Kentucky.
Man, Wheelwright, Kentucky. And so you are a prison chaplain.
Yeah, I'm a prison chaplain.
So when you were a little boy, right, and you grew up where? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Roanoke, Virginia.
Roanoke, Virginia. So when you were a little boy, I'm sure every night you thought, man, I'm going to be a prison chaplain when I grow.
I really did. My dad often said if I didn't change my attitude, I was going to end up in prison. I tell people he was right. It just took, 60 years.
You're in prison just on the other side of the experience.
I didn't believe in that.
Well, you mentioned your dad. And when you were growing up, what kind of faith tradition was there a faith tradition that you were around?
We were Southern Baptists, but we went to church when I was small. But when I was in second grade, my parents had to start working on Sundays. And so we just kind of dropped out. And that was pretty common across the board in the United States at that time. A lot of people were dropping out of church. And so I grew up, on Sunday mornings, I watched cartoons like Fearless Flying, Milton the Monster. And I did go to church, and I was a pretty rowdy child. And when I was 16, I went through a kind of adolescent crisis about what I wanted to do with my life and what was life about. And I started going to church and I accepted Christ. And my life has changed. And the people at my high school were shocked. My nickname was Firewall Hockey Rodriguez.
Firewall Hockey Rodriguez. Firewall Hockey Rodriguez. Okay.
And it's a long story. I don't remember that. The fellow that became the best man at our wedding was told that Gray Smith had become a Christian, and he said, "No, that's not possible."
So your reputation said there's no way you could become a believer.
Yeah. And he walked out into the foyer of the school one day, and I was sitting there, and he said, "I had the biggest King James Bible he'd ever seen." And I was sitting there reading, waiting for my dad to come pick me up after track practice. And after that, I felt called to ministry, and I went to Marshall College, now University, and then to Southeastern Seminary and Wake Forest, North Carolina. And then I was a pastor, and then I went back to Wake Forest University and got a master's of arts. And then I was a pastor at two congregations in Virginia. One was in Huntacre, Virginia, which is about an hour from here.
Okay.
I was there for 4 years.
Well, so in that time, you tell the story of this stunning high school, stunning conversion, right? Yeah. The young man who they thought no way could become a believer, you become a believer. And then you made this huge jump. How did you go from, being this stunning conversion or convert to actually feeling like the call to ministry?
Yeah. Well, they kind of came together. I told my parents one night, I was in their room talking to them, and I told them, I wanted to be a minister, and they were shocked. almost as much as I was. And I actually made my profession of faith several weeks after that. So, and my mother told the story that when she was pregnant with me in Norfolk, Virginia, she had a cyst on her ovary and it had to be removed. And they told her she was going to have a miscarriage. And she told them, no, I'm not. And she prayed to God and said that, you know, please give us a son. And you know, I'll keep him for 16 years old till he's 16. And then, you know, let him become a minister. And I never knew that. She never said any of that. And all those years, she watched. And, you know, it looked like an impossibility to her, too. And it was when I was 16.
Oh my goodness. So in this, I mean, a mother's plea of giving me this child and at 16, I will give, and that feels like Old Testament-like.
Yeah.
I mean, and then at 16, you become a believer and really, so your following of Jesus and being a minister almost go hand in glove, right?
Yeah.
Wow. And then you did the very traditional thing, go off to college, follow the pursuit, go to seminary, you're pastoring these churches And what was the ministry like in that traditional type of route?
It was very difficult. I had three congregations that had difficulties, and it was a tumultuous time in Baptist life anyway.
Mm.
And it was very difficult. My first congregation, I ended up in a conflict with the deacons, and I had to resign. And my son was, first son was six weeks old.
Mm.
And we went back to Roanoke and stayed with my mother-in-law and my parents. And for that summer, I basically worked for a temp company, and I loaded these huge televisions, delivered them to houses. They were the old style large screen.
Oh, yeah.
I think they're red and blue and some other color. And then I was accepted at Wake Forest University, and I went there for a year. We were actually Lutherans during that year, and I was going to go into Lutheran church, but it didn't work out. I would have to go back to seminary, and so Wake Forest kind of gave me time to sort everything out.
Yeah, that sounds like a really trying time.
It was very difficult. You know, I had a one-year-old son. My wife got a job with a daycare. And we lived in the daycare.
Oh, my goodness.
And so our son got free daycare. We lived there, and I went to class, and she stayed there and did the daycare. And it was a very difficult time. She had a miscarriage while we were there.
Wow.
She wound up having to actually go home and live with her mother because she got pneumonia, and she was pregnant again. And they said, you know, she needed to get out of the germ pool. So I was in Winston-Salem. She was in Roanoke. It's about 2 hours away. And then I got pneumonia, and I was like really sick, and she was really sick. 2 hours away. It was pretty cold.
Oh my! I mean, so young family, wife's then gonna have a miscarriage. Everyone's very sick. You've just had this difficult ministry assignment. And what kept you kind of pressing in on that call to the ministry?
It's just, you know, I just always believed that that's what God wanted me to do. And I just kept forward. And my wife helped me a lot. She encouraged me a lot. And, you know, it was very difficult for her, but she was always there for me.
Yeah.
And she was a remarkable person. She was a teacher, and very good at it. She was just a natural. We went on a mission trip to Connecticut when I was a freshman in college. She's still in high school, And I helped her with a backyard Bible club. And she was just a natural teacher. She was very good at it.
Wow. And did you know then that was going to be the person you're going to marry?
Yeah, we had been dating for a while. We were actually friends for a long time before we ever started. Our relationship kind of grew, and I think we probably, were in love, but we didn't realize it. And we were just very close friends. We had another friend, and his name was Richard, and we all kind of hung. We three hung out together. I say we were either the three musketeers or the three stooges. The only reason I say stooges is I like to refer to my wife as a stooge. Richard and I were certainly stooges. And we were just very close. And we didn't really start dating until after we went to college.
Oh, wow.
The first time I came home, I went to Virginia Tech to see my old girlfriend, thinking we would get back together. And I realized by seeing her that that wasn't going to happen. And I came home and I was talking to Wanda on the phone, and we actually started dating on the phone.
Oh, my goodness.
So we wrote a lot. Back then, you didn't have cell phones. You had the old dial-up and push buttons. You could get phones in the room, but my parents were going to let me have a phone in my room. And so we would talk probably once or twice a week, and we wrote letters. I mean, I've got a whole stack of letters we wrote to each other. And we'd see each other on the days off. And she started college in Radford, Virginia. Every once in a while we'd see each other on weekends. And she came down one time. She took a bus trip one time. And my roommate knew she was coming, but he wasn't supposed to tell me. And she said she had sent me something, and I was supposed to go pick it up.
Oh.
I kept asking him, what on earth could she have sent me that I need to go pick up at a bus station? And finally, I said, I don't know if I'm going to go up there to this bus station. He finally had to tell me.
So the logic does not add up. I'm going to pick something up at the bus station.
When I finished college, I went to a Trappist monastery for 2 weeks as a class through the college. Mm-hmm. And my roommate went with me. Several of us graduated. We graduated at noon, and at 2 o'clock we were in the car with a professor going to Conyers, Georgia, the Trappist Monastery, the Monastery of the Holy Spirit, which was a sister monastery of Gethsemane.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the monks there had actually, one of them had been a novice with Thomas Merton. And we spent 2 weeks there. And when I came home, we had been engaged for about a year. And when I came home, we decided to get married a month later. We got married on a Friday night. July 5th, the day after the 4th of July.
Wow.
We were married 34 years.
Wow, 34 years of partnership and marriage and parenting. And
yeah, three sons. One time I was teaching for the adult program at Bluefield College, and I had to go to Halifax County, Virginia, and it was like 2.5 hour drive. The class was one day a week. It was a Bible class, 6 weeks, the whole Bible, one night a week, 4 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Adult learners.
Okay.
So they all had jobs, families. They were very stressed out people. And I loved it. And so one night I got home at 11:30, and I walked through the back door of what we called the brick double wide, because our house was the same dimensions as the double wide. And she's sitting at her computer. The computer's right next to the door, the kitchen door. And it was 11:30. And she usually went to bed at 9. And she looks up at me and she says, "Your children are stupid, crazy, and mean." And I said, "Okay." And I'm thinking, well, I kind of seem to remember they're your children too, right?
Not the moment.
She told me when the oldest one, he's stupid. She told me what he did. I said, yeah, that was pretty stupid. And the middle one, he's just crazy. She told me what he did. He's the mom. Man.
Okay.
And yeah, that was kind of crazy. The little one, he's just mean. She told me what he did. Yeah, that was pretty mean. So for the rest of her days, anytime they did something she didn't like, she would look at me and say, what's my name for you?
So here you are, y'all are living life and raising the boys, and you went to seminary, and then you went back and pastored more churches, or
yeah,
what?
I was pastoring three Baptist churches.
Okay.
And after our little Lutheran interlude, and they were all difficult. My last church was it had split. Mm. I got the older group. And it was very difficult. Yeah. I went through a period of depression.
Yeah.
Then, and they said it was moderate depression. And I've always said that what I went through was moderate, and I would hate to go through the severe, because it was very, what kept me connected to reality besides my wife was I would read novels, and I would read Flannery O'Connor stories. I would read Peter DeVries, some C.S. Lewis, Walker Percy, and I couldn't even hardly read the Bible. I was just so distracted.
Mm.
And a lot of it was because they say for men that depression is anger turned in upon yourself, and I was just angry. Because I had, taken this church, it was, had so many problems, it was so difficult, and brought my family there, and I that was the source of my depression. And I saw a counselor. He had been a Baptist minister.
Okay.
So he knew where I was coming from, and that helped a lot. And through that experience, I began to search for some other answers, and we really thought we were going to go back to the Lutheran Church.
Okay.
And I visited. I was invited by. In fact, he was the former Lutheran pastor in town. He retired to the. It was called St. Mary's Orthodox Church. It was in Elkhorn, West Virginia.
Hmm.
And he invited me to go, and I went, and I just fell in love with it the first time I was there. And on the Feast of St. Nicholas, I took my sons out of school. I just had two sons at that time. She was pregnant with our third one. And I took them to St. Nicholas Day, and I said, I want my sons to grow up. I'd rather for them to grow up and be good than to be smart.
Mm.
And so they loved it. And so through that, reading the Apostolic Fathers especially,
yeah.
I did a lot of reading. I've been reading the Greek New Testament. Through that experience, I began to have a dialogue. Back then, you didn't have a podcast. you had an email dialogue.
Yeah.
It was an evangelical Orthodox dialogue. And one of the young men, he was still in college, and through this dialogue, I found myself much closer to the Orthodox thinking and positions than the evangelicals, which was surprising. And he sent me a liturgy book from the Antiochian diocese. I still have it. And he mentioned me to Father Peter Gilquist, who led a group of about over 2,000 evangelicals. They had been involved with Campus Crusade, and they began to search for the church, because they felt like in Campus Crusade, they had a lot of individual faith, but they didn't have community. And they began to read the fathers and And they started what they called the Evangelical Orthodox Church. And eventually they were received into Antiochian church, and about 2,000 of them were chrismated into Orthodoxy on Pentecost Sunday.
Wow.
Back in I think it was the late 70s or early 80s. And so Father Peter had been their bishop, and Orthodox, our bishops aren't married, and he was married. So he was more than glad to stop being a bishop. He called me on the phone, and we talked for about 2 hours, and that influenced me a whole lot. And I finally talked to my wife, and we started attending I resigned from my congregation, and we got a house there in Paris.
So I'll pause you there for a second. So you are a Baptist minister, but having a real, I mean, maybe not a crisis of faith, but really you're having moderate depression, and you're having a really hard time reading the Bible. I mean, just the only thing giving you solace is your wife and these novels, but you never give up on this idea of searching for God, right? But the church has really kind of smoked you in very significant ways. So you get invited by a friend in the middle of nowhere, West Virginia. Middle of nowhere, West Virginia. And that's where you encountered Orthodoxy. Okay, that just blows my mind. So you encounter Orthodoxy, you go, you start reading, because you're a reader and you're a smart guy, so you just keep diving in that way. And then you begin this dialogue, and then a pretty significant leader of that movement calls you.
Yeah.
So, but then you kind of load everything up and go all in?
Yeah, and we talked about it a whole lot, and she was more reluctant, and that's been our experience up until recently. Orthodoxy has appealed to males more than females. That's begun to change. And she was reluctant. She was kind of dissettled by everything, and she said she probably wouldn't have gone to church if it wasn't for me. And so one night, you know, I'm trying to decide what am I going to do to make a living. And she wanted me to do the career switcher program to teach. And she said, you're a good teacher. And I didn't know if I really wanted to do that. And she didn't know if she really wanted to, you know, become Orthodox. And one night she says, I will become Orthodox if you will go to the career switcher plan. So I spit on my hand and raised it. She didn't take my hand. And so that was, you know, kind of the ceiling moment of that. And we became catechumens. The church in Elkhorn moved to Bluefield.
Okay.
It was interesting, the people there, they were always good to us. And when they moved to Bluefield, they grew, but the man who was the reader, he became my middle son's godfather. And Jim Frazier, he died a few weeks ago. And Jim went to school with the older brother of the guy that the October Sky was the movie was about.
Oh my goodness. How about that?
And that older brother was a football coach in Roanoke for like 30 some years. The rival high school from my high school.
Okay.
And so it's kind of interesting those connections. But they're you know, it was just a really warm and wonderful parish, and we went there. We ended up moving back to Roanoke because my middle son, who's now a monk, had Asperger's, and my wife always knew he had Asperger's.
Okay.
And I just thought, well, you've just been to too many teacher conferences. And we moved back to Roanoke because he couldn't get the help he needed where we were. We knew back in our home schools, we went to school, that he would be able to get good help, and he did. And it, it, it was really worthwhile. And she got a job teaching. I still did. I worked for Bluefield College and for 8 years in their adult program, driving all over Southwest Virginia. Really loved it. I'd have loved to have done it full time, but it just never did work out. We moved back home. We bought the brick double wide, which was literally about 100 yards from my dad's house, the house I grew up in.
Okay.
And we saw my dad every day. And we would go to Bluefield to church on Sunday. So Sunday and feast days, we would go to Bluefield. And it was an hour and 45-minute drive.
Wow.
And people were stunned that we still went there. After about 8 years, we started going to the Greek Orthodox Church in town because gas got high and my wife was having a hard time. You know, we were getting older and she's having a hard time after the long trip on Sunday and, you know, going to school on Monday. So we started, I served at the Greek Orthodox Church. By then, I'd become a subdeacon in the church. And we served there for 9 years, and we still would go to Bluefield on occasions. And Father Mark Tyson, whom I met in Johnstown, Pennsylvania at the Altar Boys Retreat in the summer of, it was in June of 2001. And we just hit it off real well. And then he ended up, our pastor retired. And our priest that received us in the Orthodoxy, he told me that Father Mark was the best priest in the diocese.
Wow.
And so that November, someone told me that he was coming there, and I said, "You're kidding me." And he was there for, 18 or 19 years.
Wow.
And we're still very close. He did my wife's funeral.
Okay.
I ended up being his son's sponsor at their wedding about 4 or 5 years ago. So in Orthodoxy, the godparents in the word for the sponsor at the wedding is the same word as it's kumbari, and it's the same word as used for godparents.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's kind of the idea that water is thicker than blood.
Sure, absolutely, yes, yeah.
So we're kind of related now.
Yeah.
So I go see him a lot. We did this for all these years. And back in 2017, I was sitting in our room waiting for my wife to come home, and it was on Dr. Seuss's birthday. And I had been to her classroom to read, because I was there to read to her students. She taught kindergarten, and she also, that year, she was teaching second grade, and she said, "I always got them all stirred up." I would go in, and I would change the story, and they would say, "No, Mr. Smith, that's not how it is." And I would call, how are y'all today, monsters? And I said, "We're not monsters, we're little children." And so she said, "You know, I would go get them started up and take the rest of the day for them to get them to calm back down." But she always liked for me to come read to them. So I'm sitting there reading the Greek New Testament, and the phone rings, and I answer it, and it's the hospital. And I'd been a chaplain at that hospital for 4.5 years, and it was the ER. They said, "Your wife was found unresponsive in her car, and she's here." And my mind just went blank, because, you know, I'd been at the bedside of many unresponsive people. And the first thing I thought of was, in a day or two, I'm going to have to decide whether to take her off a respirator or not. Because that's what I was thinking of.
Sure, yeah.
I said, the nurse must have thought I was crazy. I said, "I guess I need to come over." Because, I mean, when that happens, something like that happens, your mind just it goes blank. I mean, you don't really know what you're saying. And so I went over there and walked in. And by that time, she had come to. And I got there just in time for the doctor to come and see and say, you know, you have a mass on your brain. I'd been in that very bay where she was many times and heard the same news given to other people. It's really different when it's you.
You're on the other side of the bed this time. Yeah.
And so we went through, she had glioblastoma, which is the most aggressive kind of brain tumor. And it can double in size in 2 weeks. And the hospital kept changing her appointments because they wanted her to get a re-imaging. And so one day she's taking her mother came to live with us. Her mother had a spinal stroke and she lived with us for 8 years. And she's taking her mother to the doctor. She says, I'm going to ask, and her mother's doctor was our old doctor, but because of insurance stuff, we couldn't go to him anymore. I'm going to ask him about this. And so I said, well, I'll go with you. So we, you know, after my mother-in-law's appointment, I went back. And she told him, you know, the whole thing. And he said, Wanda, I don't like anything you're telling me. Stay right here. I'll be back in a few minutes. And he came back in and he had the number. He had called Duke University.
Wow.
And got her an appointment with, his name was Freeman. And he was, we went down there the next day.
Oh my goodness, wow.
And they hit it off real well. And he was a little short, a Jewish doctor. And he had, and she had him laughing.
Yeah.
So, he told her, you know, you're going to have to have it removed. And she wanted to wait till the end of the school year.
That's a real teacher. That's a teacher right there, yeah.
Said, no, you got to have it removed, you know, now. So it was Holy Week.
Mm.
And on Holy Monday, she had her brain surgery. So I'm sitting out in the waiting room. And here comes this crowd of people. And it's kind of boisterous and loud. And in front of this crowd of people is Dr. Freeman. And there are all these people in the lobby whispering, it's Dr. Freeman. It's Dr. Freeman. And I'm, you know, we're just saying, well, what's going on here? And somebody told me, oh, yeah, Dr. Freeman's like the rock star of his field. He had done 10 Kennedy's brain surgery.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, wow.
And so he did her surgery, and, you know, it turned out well for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not allowed to stay with her that night in ICU. But back home, I could have stayed with her.
Sure.
And I come in the next morning, she's yelling at the nurse because the nurse is trying to give her pain meds.
Okay.
And she wouldn't take it.
Oh.
Yeah, she just wouldn't take it. And Dr. Freeman had told her she could take Tylenol or you know, ibuprofen, but the resident said, no, you could have a bleed and bleed to death. It's like, okay, she's got a brain tumor. You know, it's what's the deal? So she didn't have any pain medicine until after we left. And she was having hallucinations. And in fact, the Dr. Freeman's office called her. We were at Red Lobster in Durham, North Carolina, eating lunch. And she says, you know, I'm having these hallucinations. In fact, right now, there's this homeless man sitting next to my husband in the booth, and he's reaching over trying to get my husband's food. And she had these, I mean, we were walking to the laundry room, and she said, Peppy, would you just run out in front of us? And I said, well, I don't know. I didn't see it. And she had that for, you know, the rest of her day. She knew that they were not real.
Yes, so she knew she was having these hallucinations, but knew they weren't real.
And the funniest one was we were at the church, and we came into the Russian Orthodox Church out of the Carpathian Russians because of the conflict over the ecumenical patriarch. Patriarch Constantinople, put forth the claim that he was the first without equals, when in Orthodoxy, since ancient times, the Patriarch and the Pope were considered to be first among equals.
Okay.
And so we ended up, Paul Mark and I ended up going to the Russian Orthodox Church. And we were received in a little parish in Bogota, near Natural Bridge, Virginia, out in the middle of nowhere. And only it was the priest, his wife, Wanda, and me. And so one Sunday, we were sitting there having dinner, because you usually have dinner after church in Orthodoxy, because so many people have to drive so far.
Okay.
And you fast from midnight until communion, so people need something to be able to make the long drives home.
Mm.
So we're eating dinner, and all of a sudden my wife pops up and says, "Did I see Porky the Pig in a Canadian bounty outfit coming back behind the altar and salute?" And I look at Father, and he looks at me and he says, "You're not doing your job. You're supposed to keep people like that out from the altar." And she had a comic book, which is a little hat, Porky the Pig.
Oh, and a Canadian.
Canadian mounting outfit, saluting. And we looked it up on the internet, actually, and saw it. And that's what she hallucinated. Porky Pig came out from, I don't know. Through her illness, it was very hard, very, very difficult. And she always asked why, because she hadn't even been to the doctor yet.
Okay. So it just went straight brain tumor, yeah.
And she always asked why has this happened. And I always asked, I never asked why. I read in very early on, it came to mind where St. Paul writes to the Romans, whether we live for the Lord, whether we die for the Lord, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. And that somehow kept me going for those 2.5 years that she was sick. And I always asked, how am I going to get through this?
Okay. Yeah. So not why, but how am I going to get through
it? Her question was why. She wasn't angry about it. She wasn't angry with God about it. She just, she was just kind of overwhelmed by it. And it was a real struggle. But through that, I always thought, I was the pastor.
Yeah.
The minister, I was always out in front. She was quiet, reserved, always working hard behind the scenes. And I always thought, I was the stuff that kept the family together.
Yeah.
I'm a man. Yeah. What I learned through that was that I was totally wrong.
She was the rock.
She was the one. And she had friends that would come see her. And I told her, and I would sometimes get kind of upset. I said, these people aren't going to be here at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen this over and over in ministry and chaplaincy. At the end, nobody's there. It's just you and your family.
That's right, yeah.
And I figured that's how it's going to be. They came all the way literally up to the end.
Wow.
She was always concerned about how they were doing and not about how she was doing. She was really amazing. And it's through all that I realized, she was the one, and I think probably everybody else knew. and she was the one that was really uncommon.
Yeah.
And it kind of was the lesson of that is there are probably many, many people like that who are the unsung and uncommon people that are anonymous.
Mm.
And in our society, we want to be rich and famous and well-known and everybody paying attention to us. And, the best people are the people that you never know about.
It's the invisible, faithful people. And I'm really taken by your wife's willingness to jump in this tradition, right? Yeah. That really, I mean, changed the whole trajectory of y'all's life. And here you are driving an hour and 45 minutes or so to church one way and raising kids and, you know, your one son on the spectrum, which creates unique kind of dynamics in and of itself. And so you guys journeyed for 2.5 years.
And my middle son became a monk during that time. My older son, him and his girlfriend broke up. He dated her for 8 years.
Wow.
She was seeing somebody else. He had bought her a wedding ring, was going to propose to her, and he was devastated. My youngest son was a freshman in college. He graduated high school, was a freshman in college. My middle son became a monk. He graduated from Liberty University with a magna cum laude.
Wow.
And all of that, she was keeping up with them and doing for her mother. And it was just really amazing to see how she worked. She had to wear, it was called Optune. It was a device. You shave your head.
Oh, yeah. And guess cap like thing.
Cap.
Yeah.
And hook up to a battery. And she wore that for, you know, all probably 10 months. And it was supposed to keep new tumor. And while she wore it, she didn't have any new tumors developed. And I would have to shave her head.
Okay.
And then when I, you know, said I do, for better or for worse, I never dreamed I'd have to shave my wife's head.
Yeah.
And put those things on her. And she ended up having to stop using it because it began to burn her little bit of hair that was come up. I'd shave her head twice a week.
Wow.
And then it started shocking her. They said she, and after that, you know, 2 or 3 months after she stopped wearing it, the tumor started coming back. And she was really afraid that she would lose the ability to recognize anybody, and she never did. She started having problems on her left side. She played the piano, and she would come to the hospital, chapel in the middle hospital in Roanoke for 7.5 years, and she would come to the services and play. And her last Christmas, she came to the Christmas Eve service, and she really made a lot of mistakes, and she just told me she wasn't going to be able to do it anymore. She was really hard, but I went through the day she had to retire. She had to take early retirement.
What a painful day.
Yeah, it really was. I had to drive her around the summer that she had. I thought we were going to get divorced. Because she would say, go this way. And I would go my way. And she would like that. And it was really hard because, you know, she was very independent. And all of a sudden, she had to depend on me to take her everywhere. And go to the grocery store through. And she didn't like that.
Yeah.
Because I would throw things in the bucket.
Well, you know, in this journey, I hear this theme of surrendering to what's in front of you. You know, you take this huge leap of faith because it's just, you're convicted that orthodoxy is the path.
Yeah.
And then your wife, who is really the rock of the family, has this devastating diagnosis, and you surrender to, okay, this is what life's going to be like now, right?
Yeah.
And you continue to just to kind of go with what is presented in front of you. And your ministry career is really kind of secondary almost. Yeah. It feels like, you know, so many ministers, that's like the defining thing of their life, you know? And for you, this is secondary. You've mentioned only in passing, it's like, oh yeah, I was at the hospital as a chaplain, and then I was at this mental hospital as a chaplain. And but really your family is dictating everything. Yeah. And then your wife that succumbs to the brain tumor.
Yeah.
And
the day she died, he was always with her. Now we never knew how he knew, but he knew.
You're talking about your little dog here. That everyone's clicking around. Your dog's name is.
And he was right next to her all the time. And when we had to put the hospital bed in our room, he literally would be plastered up against her. And all the nurses that came in, you know, would comment about it. And the day before she died, a new nurse came in from hospice, and she says, "Is this your partner in crime?" She said, "I don't need a partner." And because she just had a real quick wit, and she was very funny, but it was very, you know, very quiet.
Yeah.
And so that next day, he would not get near her. He stayed away from her all day. And he wouldn't get in the bed or anything. I put him up in the bed, and he jumped down.
Wow.
So that evening, she was having some problems, and I called the hospice and asked the nurse if he wanted to come over. I said, "Yeah." And I was sensing that it was closed, but it's different.
Yeah, 100% different. Yep.
And I just didn't know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you really don't want, you know, I didn't want her to die.
Yeah.
I'm seeing everything that I'd seen many times. And so the nurse comes over and changes her. She cuts her nightie so it'll be more comfortable. And it was about 11:30. She's getting ready. And she said she may not make it through the night. And I told her, I said, "Yeah, that's why I called you. That's what I kind of was thinking, but I wasn't sure." So I sat there with her and I sang her hymns, some of them out of our Carpathian Russian book. I said the prayers of the church for those who were dying. I read some scripture, and you know, about 1:30, I couldn't get my youngest son was still living at home. I couldn't get him to wake up. Her mother wouldn't wake up, and I just figured that. I mean, I have learned that is that people really do have some sort of control over what happens.
Absolutely.
People who are waiting, they won't die until some certain person's there. My dad, I'm convinced, waited until my son and I left. He died probably 10 minutes after we left.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that's how she wanted it. And you know, I was with her when she passed, and it was too far for any of the priests to come. And on that short notice in the middle of the night. And so I was basically her priest.
Mm.
The Orthodox Church will say, you know, the father of the family is the priest of the family. The family is a little church. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, but I think it's the best thing I've ever done. It was.
Mm.
And so the next morning, my father Mark called me, and we're talking, and he tells me about this meme he saw. It was called the Amazing Untattooed Woman.
Amazing Untattooed Woman.
This carnival barker. And he said, "Come see the Amazing Untattooed Woman." And I just said, I'm right then, as soon as he said, I knew, you know, I'm going to write a book about my wife, and that's really the title.
Okay.
And so I was going to write a biography, but I never could get it together to do it. And I wrote poems.
Mm.
So I wrote all these poems about her, and I published it on Amazon. It's called The Amazing Untattooed Woman. That's one of the poems.
Okay.
And so, you know, it's been 5 years. She died on August 15th in 2019. Mm. Interestingly enough, it was the feast day for the parish in Bluefield. The Dormition of the Mother of God, it was the feast day. She died.
Wow.
The feast day of the parish. And we've always seen the significance of that. And you know, it's been 5 years and it's still very difficult to grasp.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you don't really you know, they talk about closure. I'm not really sure if you have closure. You just kind of, you know, get used to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just get used to it. And, you know, you mentioned the prayers of the church and the hymns. And how did your orthodoxy and how has your orthodoxy sustained you during that time and during these 5 years of grief.
Yeah. It, you know, well, we pray for the departed, and that has helped a great deal. I light candles for our church. I have candles at home I light for too. And say the prayers for her, and that helps. You know, when she first departed, I felt very close to her, almost like her presence was with me. So there have been times since then I haven't, and it's bothered me. And you know, it's just in the Orthodox Church, the you know, the living and the dead are all part of the church. They're all one. And so it's not like, well, they're dead and gone and they're no longer important.
Okay.
And you know, my sons talk about her a whole lot and her faith. And it's really interesting. My oldest son and my youngest son were really not going to church or anything. They, you know, they were in their 20s and they dropped out. And my oldest son, he met a Catholic girl and they got married, and he, you know, started going back to church. And we talk a whole lot. And my youngest son, he recently is starting going back to church. And they actually went up to visit his brother the monk last weekend.
Okay.
Told him about it. And then the monk told me about that. And they had a good time together. But they all talk about, you know, their mother and their faith and her influence on them. And you know, if they got in trouble with me, that wasn't so bad. If they got in trouble with her, it was, you know, it was really bad. I mean, she knew how to get through to them.
Okay. She knew how to kind of lay it out.
Yeah, and it, you know, she would always tell them, they would come try, of course, they'd try to split us to get what they wanted, and she would tell them, Mom and Daddy are on the same team. Every once in a while, she would tell them something that they couldn't do.
Okay.
And they would come to me and say, Dad, Mom won't let us do this. And if you know, something, I thought, well, you know, I'll go talk to her and say, you know, I think this would be okay because, you know, I used to do this. And so she would say, okay, if you think it's all right, then we will. And there was not many times like that. But every once in a while, my children talk about how strict we were.
Okay.
Compared to their peers, as we were, we weren't really, in our minds, strict, you know. But
turns out you were, I guess.
I guess, yeah. And they, of all, appreciated the stress appreciation.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, you talk about these firm boundaries as a parent and this structure and... Now, in these last 5 years, you've had a vocational change.
Yeah.
Doing something now that you had not mentioned in this story at all, that probably takes some firm boundaries and having to kind of toe the line.
Yeah.
You have now dove in this, which I really admire, right, as your life has really changed.
Yeah.
You have moved locations, you've moved professions, and you now find yourself in a medium security prison.
Yeah.
In Eastern Kentucky, nowhere middle of Eastern Kentucky, and you're a prison chaplain. And, like, that's a world that most people have no idea about.
Yeah. People ask me, how did you get here? And I said, well, I saw on the internet. And I went through 20 years of unemployment, underemployment, overemployment, you know, all part-time things. I worked 5 part-time jobs at one time.
Wow.
And that was one of the things my wife and I always talked about. And she always helped me, you know, fill out, because I'm terrible. She said, you're formally impaired. You give me a form on this.
Formally impaired.
And so I see this job that I applied for, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is like the other million jobs that I applied for. I'll never hear anything. Well, I'm coming home from the mental hospital. It's 3 in the afternoon. And I pull in the driveway, and this phone call comes in. Is this Haywood Smith? That's my first name, Haywood. I go by Gray. I'm a junior.
Okay.
Yes. Are you interested in coming for an interview for the chaplain position at Southeast State Correctional Complex in Gilroy, Kentucky? Yes. Well, be here at 9 o'clock on Wednesday. Okay. Click. So, you know, all of a sudden I've got to scramble to get ready, because that was Friday, and I had to scramble to get ready to come here, and I had very little money. So I came to Blackwell to stay the night, and I packed my suit. About 10:45, I was getting ready to go to bed. I got my suit out, and I realized I didn't bring a shirt. I didn't bring a tie. I have a suit, and I'm thinking, okay, it's either Don Johnson from Miami Rock, or I'm gonna, you know, I brought my casket with me because I was going to church in Bristol, Tennessee, and I was going to go to Vespers afterwards. And I said, it's either that, or, you know, I'm gonna have to wear my casket. And I'm sure these people have never seen any man in a black dress before. So I thought, oh, wait a minute, there's Walmart. So I look up on Walmart, and Walmart opens 24/7. And so I head over to Walmart here, and I'm out in the parking lot there yelling, we're closed, because it was COVID. So
oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm driving Abner Mountain.
Okay, very windy. Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I grew up in the mountains, but Abner is a different mountain. I've been to places in West Virginia, and my son was a monk in West Virginia for a while. He said, this reminds me of the monk, the road on the monastery. He said, this road is a lot worse than the road on the monastery. And then we got over to the monastery, over to the parish area, and he said, Dad, you're right. He would be holding on to the dashboard. So I'm going up Abner, and I'm wearing a casket, and I'm thinking, why am I even going to show up? I should just turn around and go home.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I get there, and I go in, and I'm wearing this black robe. And you know, there's no like Orthodox, like you said.
Yeah, nowhere.
And I'm thinking, they're just going to think, this guy is just not willing to. And I'm talking to this committee, and the deputy warden pipes up that about 10 minutes and says, gosh, it's like somebody sent you to us. And about 10 minutes later, he just looks at them and says, I don't think we need the order for them. Let's just hire him now. HR has to tell him, well, you know, we got somebody else. So I leave there, and I thought, well, I've never had an interview with that whale.
Wow.
And I didn't hear anything. It's like 6 weeks later, you know. So, well, I guess that, you know,
it didn't go as well as I thought.
Wearing a black dress. It's a Friday at 3 o'clock. I just pulled in the driveway. The phone rings. Is this Haywood Smith? Yes. Are you here? We want to offer you the job at Southeast State Correctional Complex as chaplain. Are you interested in taking it? Yes. Be here on November 16th.
No details. Just.
And I had to call him back and say, you know, I don't, because that was like November. That was like Halloween or something.
Yeah, so the next pay period,
I
be here.
I sell my house. So I ended up, I sold my house. My oldest son had a friend who's a realtor, and he's my age.
Okay.
We went to school together, but we didn't know each other.
Oh.
And he was 2 years older than me. And he bought the house to turn it over. And I didn't have time to get rid of anything. And so I left like 5,000 volumes of my books there, which I could have brought them to the prison.
I've
always regretted that. All the furniture, I mean.
Oh, just, wow.
You know, I gave a whole lot of stuff to Goodwill, but I couldn't. I mean, I had a four-level split ranch And I had the stuff of 14 people in it. My grandparents, my parents, my wife's parents, her grandparents.
Yeah, you really had generational.
All my children. And it's like, you know, I didn't have time to get rid of it all. So, you know, Mike said, just leave it there and we'll take care of it. So I don't know where to do it. And I you know, I came here. My friend brought my stuff up, and my roommate from college is a pastor in Bristol. He came up and helped him unload the
crane.
And they unloaded it. And I had to stay and wait to get my check for my house. So Ben and I got in our car and came up here, and I took a long turn, and I went the long way to get to Wheelwright. And we're out in the middle. It's like pitch dark, and all of a sudden these two bears are in the road. And they run up. I mean, I had no idea that they ran up like a cliff that was like this.
Yep.
It's like, wow. But I consider that a good sign. And so I've had a lot of difficulty. Getting my internet, that took 3 months.
Man.
Because I couldn't figure out where I was.
Sure, yeah.
Everything took a long time. It was very, very frustrating. I was on the job the first day. I had to get to tell the inmate his mother died.
Oh, man. First day. Wow.
Yeah, first day. And he comes in and, you know, I'm very sorry to tell you, but your mother has died. And he sits there stone faced. I was in the trauma bay for 4.5 years. You know, people come in, suicide, everything. And you would tell their family, and you're used to people breaking down. He just stood there stone faced. And he was quiet for about 30 seconds. And he says, okay, can I go back to work? It's like, wow, this is a different world.
So that was wow, what an introduction to.
It's very different. I never expected.
And so what's it been like, you know, for people who maybe have no idea what it's like for inmate spirituality, what have you experienced in your time of serving inmates?
Well, when they come in, you never really know what to expect, because a lot of inmates are always playing an angle.
Okay.
Yeah. So you don't know what angle they're playing. But you have to pastorally treat them like they're telling you the truth. Mm-hmm. And everything's on the up and up. And, you know, if somebody comes in and says, you know, my mother died, and, you know, I need a phone call, and you don't want to say, no, she didn't.
Yeah, so you have to assume best intentions.
Yeah, and I have had, you know, inmates who literally lied about their mother died. If, you know, you'll go to check it out, and they'll say, well, his mother died 6 months ago. And then it turns out she's still alive.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Yeah.
So so you have to approach things, being suspicious, but you really can't show your suspicions.
Okay.
Because you don't want to break a potential relationship that they need. And you never know when somebody really comes to you with a problem. Yeah, the other thing is, in prison, they can change their religious preference once every 6 months.
Okay.
And they often change, like when Passover comes on, everybody wants to be a Jew because you get the Passover menu.
Oh, so change my religion based on the menu.
Yeah. And that was hard to understand. If they get on the kosher movement, we don't have a kosher kitchen, so they have to be transferred somewhere that has kosher kitchen. And they want to be transferred, so they say, you know, I'm going to go to a kosher movement. And so you have to explain to them, okay, you got to stay on this kosher movement for years. If you break it, they're going to send you right back here.
Okay.
So, you know, we don't want you here anymore, so don't come back. I told God one day, I said, well, you probably really shouldn't change your religious preference just to get transferred. Yeah, just right by it.
Gotcha. He changed it, yeah.
Yeah, and one guy, he sat in the SEG unit for like 6 months after he because we couldn't get anybody taken, because, you know, why am I not transferred yet? Well, you know, we put in for your transfer, but somebody has to take you. And we can't just put you in the van
and take you somewhere.
And so, you know, you have that aspect of it. It's always interesting. It's never boring. You never know, you know, it's like life's like a little box of chocolates. Prison's like chocolate on steroids. And occasionally you'll have people come in, or inmates come in, and they have a real need, and you're able to do something for them. And you know, those are the kind of things you tend to appreciate it more. When I was at the hospital, there was only one patient who ever declined my services. I was in the trial bay, I was wearing my cassock, and he points, it says to the nurse, "Who's that man in the black robe?" "Well, he's the chaplain." "Well, I don't want him, I'm wicked." So, and tell him to leave. I said, "Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
If you need me, just let him know." But that was the only time, because, you know, mostly in the hospital, if you're in, you know, ER, and people that are in need, you know, they
open to prayer.
They appreciate you. In prison, it's not that way. I mean, you just never know what's going to happen. And a whole lot of what I do is I'm like the clearinghouse for all the different religious items that are allowed to get, and I have to guide them through that. And because of the policies, they have to order items from the canteen, the inmate canteen that are offered there. And they don't want those items, they want something else. And you can't, you know, and I'm always in this dance. It's like, you can't order that because the canteen offers it, you have to buy it from them. I was in the great tarot card controversy the past 6 weeks with the Wiccans. Well, those tarot cards they have, they look cartoonish and they're an insult and they don't last long. It's like, I don't feel your pain. I can't change the policy. Right?
Wow. So here you are, you're trying to serve the inmate, go according to DOJ or DOC policy, and really, and you're the middle person.
Yeah.
That's wow.
Yeah, then it's always fun. Well, you know, I'll go ask the warden, and I know what the warden's going to say. And well, the warden said no. And then they're mad at you because, you know, the warden said no. Well, you know, I didn't make the policy.
You're just enforcing.
I had somebody today who basically wanted me to, you know, overturn this policy. And I was like, I told them they're not going to let you do that. Well, can you advocate for me? And I never said yes. But I said, well, I'll ask them. And, you know, and I will ask them. But I know what they're going to say because I know what the policy is.
Right.
And it's they never seem to quite get that. And, you know, you get a lot of complaints. And I get grievances. You know, they grieve the chaplain of the Passover. I got grievances. Somebody went to see a rabbi. The first evening of Passover, we wanted to talk to a rabbi immediately at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
And Wheelwright, Kentucky.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, the nearest rabbi is, you know, 3 hours away. And, you know, it's Passover. He probably won't be available. And I agree for that. You know, I said, I'll be glad to set you up a meeting. Won't be tonight.
Yeah, know? Right.
And because he wanted to complain about the food. It turned out all the food was done precisely according to the policy.
Wow.
He was claiming that he's supposed to get more.
Okay.
It was out of there. But yeah, the religious meals are a big deal. And they're always a lot to play. And no matter what you do, because my first year, I went through a Passover and Ramadan. They were the same time.
Oh,
and
man.
And I had to put them in the same room with the divider between them. It's like, you know, and you know, Israel and Hamas, they weren't at war like they are now. They still were not, like, not in good terms. I'm thinking, you know, World War III will start. If we don't write it, then it'll be my fault.
Your last words were, I was just following the policy.
So I said, next year I'm going to start all this earlier, and I did, but still.
It didn't work out.
And then Ramadan and Passover are at the same time this year, so you know it'll be easier. It was hard. And it's like, did they sit around and say, let's see how we can make the chaplain's life miserable? So, you know, as a chaplain, you know, I am like in between. Because I work with the inmates. Yet at the same time, you know, I work with staff, and the staff and the inmates are, you know, it reminds me of Bugs Bunny, the you know, the coyote and the sheepdog.
Yeah.
And they're just natural adversaries. You know? Outside of prison, they can probably get along, but you know, in prison, they have to be adversaries. And I'm kind of like stuck between them. And I mean, there's no question of where I have to be. I have to be on the side of the security. And I hear a lot of complaints about staff. Some of them, most of them are just not true.
Yeah.
Like I received a complaint about a staff member who was claimed that this inmate said he felt threatened and they were going to kill him that weekend. And I have to go report it.
Sure.
It turned out that the staff member he accused was not even there the day in which he accused him of having said all these things. He was just, you know, saying it because he was trying to get transferred.
Wow.
And so, you know, you have this thing where you're kind of between the staff and the inmates. And, it's hard because you know a lot of times you know that inmates are going to try to play.
Yeah.
And at the same time, there are situations where you really do feel compassion for them. And even, you know, some of their crimes are just horrific, but you still feel the compassion that, you know, this person has, you know, made such a terrible decision that he's, you know, in prison for years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's cut off from his family. And, you know, when like a family member dies, it's a lot harder for them.
Okay.
Because they can't be there.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they feel guilt for not being able to be there. And you know, maybe their relationship with their parents wasn't very good anyway.
Yeah, maybe problematic, yeah.
And so it's just a lot of, it's, you know, the grief is a lot more. And then there's the added feature that if they show their tender emotions, then, you know, that might be read as a sign of weakness, and somebody might decide to hit them with a lock and a sock, you know. It's a very difficult life, but I really enjoyed it. The thing that has kept me going through all of it is that the people I work with they've just been very good to me.
That's beautiful.
And there's been days when, you know, I've wanted just to walk out of the place. I've just had enough today. Today was one of those days. I'm glad it's Friday. But you know, the staff has just been, they're just been so good to me.
That's great.
And they're very genuine.
Yeah.
The people of our region are just very genuine, very plain spoken. I mean, you know, you don't have to know where you stand. And you know, they do, they'll do a lot of things that probably shock me. And then, you know, they'll curse and they'll say, "Oh, sorry, Joe." But, well, you probably not say anything I haven't said myself.
Well, you have lived a journey, but I'm also just really struck by the contrast. You know, you talk about your wife's health and the years that she had hallucinations, and she was able to kind of know that, you know, Porky the Pig was not in a Mountie suit coming up behind the altar. And here you are now living in a world where you have to always be constantly discerning, is this true or not, you know? And in your journey of watching your wife and her relationships and your relationships that sustain you through all the years and have really kept you inside that Orthodox tradition, the relationships you've made to the point that you're willing to drive 2 hours to go to church. And here you are now talking about your profession, and it's really the relationships around you and your coworkers. And well, I really appreciate you sharing your faith journey. And as we close, is there any kind of prayer or something from your tradition that you could offer? Maybe that you could, would there be something that would be like Orthodox that you might want to leave people with?
Yeah, the Jesus prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, sinner. And, I find myself, we're supposed to pray that without ceasing, like St. Paul says to the Thessalonians. That's one method through the ages that's been used by special monks to try to pray without ceasing. And I find myself praying an awful lot. And I often tell even inmates that, you know, there's not a lot of difference between me and you. Mm-hmm. Maybe what you've done is when you were called for it. And maybe it's worse as far as human society goes. But, you know, we're all sinners and we need God's mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I try to depend on. And I don't always do such a good job of it, but receiving mercy and giving mercy. You know, there's sometimes I'll be angry at inmates. They lie to you. It's hard not to be angry. It's hard not to just say, "Oh, gosh."
Sure.
But, you know, so after a while, you just try to say, you know, be merciful to them and realize, you know, God knows me and he knows what I've done and he knows what I think and they're, I'm no better than them.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all need the mercy of God and maybe there's something I can do to help them on that path. And I think there are things that they've done, that inmates have done for me that have, you know, helped me, you know, see things and find mercy. So, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there's, when I first started, staff members told me, he says, you know, we're in an atmosphere of continual evil all the time.
Mm.
And he said it wears on you. It changes you. And it was really disturbing. Because, you know, he was a Christian. He was some kind of a minister. And his, you know, devoutness had suffered. And, and a lot of it was because of the job. And, you know, and that is the atmosphere we're in. You know, it's a serious place. I mean, sometimes you can feel the evil around you. But in the midst of that, you know, there are also God's goodness is still, you know, overcoming all these things. And so I often try to remember that mean, it's a very sparse, I mean, you've been there plenty of times, so you know what it's like. I mean, it's very sparse. I don't think anybody would build a home patterned after the decor of a prison.
No, it's not the most charming and homey environment.
In the Orthodox Church, we have icons and all of these things, and beauty, and Dostoevsky's saying, "Beauty will save the world."
That's great.
An expression of Orthodoxy, and then you get in the prison, it's like, wow.
Yeah, it's definitely not that. Well, that's incredible. I appreciate you sharing that, the Jesus prayer. Yeah. You know, as you recite that over and over and over, I mean, it grounds you, but also reminds you of your own, you know, sinfulness, and creating an avenue for other sinners to feel welcomed and embraced and ready to meet them at wherever they're at. So, well, I really admire your journey. I appreciate you hanging out with us and kind of telling us a little bit more. I don't know if Eastern Kentucky is going to become a hotbed of Orthodoxy, but at least we got one. So,
Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't know.